Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is War in a Digital Age. With me to discuss how technology, innovation, and social media are shaping Russia's war in Ukraine and what it might mean for the future is Audrey Kurth Cronin. Audrey is a distinguished professor in the School of International Service at American University, where she is the founding director of the Center for Security, Innovation, and New Technology. She was previously a specialist in terrorism at the Congressional Research Service, and she has held a number of positions in the executive branch, including in the Office of the Secretary of Defense for Policy. Audrey's most recent book is Power to the People, How Open Technological Innovation is Arming Tomorrow's Terrorists, which was shortlisted for the Lionel Gelber Prize and won the 2020 Erie Neve Prize. Audrey, thanks for joining me.
It's a pleasure, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Audrey, I want to begin with the technology piece of all of this and get your assessment of how technology, whether high technology or low technology, has shaped the battlefield in Ukraine.
Well, I think technology has been important both in communications and also in how some of the operations have unfolded. I think we do have to be careful to not get too breathless about the role of technology, particularly since a lot of what is happening is old-fashioned artillery and old-fashioned tanks and a lot of very well-established technologies. But in shaping the origins of the war and also in how it's unfolded, I think there are a lot of lessons for us about what types of technologies are going to be important moving forward. And I think we have to pay a lot of attention to those. For one thing, decentralized technologies have been very prominent when it comes to operations on the battlefield.
Well, let me stop you right there, Audrey. When you say decentralized technologies, what do you mean by that? What comes to mind for you?
I mean technologies that are easily accessible to individuals, that are easy to use, that are human carried, that are sometimes driven by autonomous capabilities. Drones are the obvious example, but not just large drones like the TB2, the Turkish TB2, but also Polish-produced Warmate drone, kamikaze drones that have been used, the Switchblade capabilities that we have given from our special operations.
That's a U.S. drone, the Switchblade.
It's the small, the very small. There are actually two sizes, but both of them are extremely small, and one of the two can loiter so that it can actually target individuals on the ground. This has been very important in killing Russians, frankly.
So what are those drones used to attack? Do they attack individuals? Do they attack artillery? Do they attack tanks?
The Switchblade attacks individuals. So it doesn't have, you know, huge explosive capability, but it's an extraordinarily important weapon from the point of view of morale. So we've heard a lot about how the Russians are not very high in their morale. For one thing, I think they were ill-prepared. And one of the things that has had an impact on that morale has been these very small weapons that the Ukrainians have been using and that the West has been supplying them.
Have we seen the Russians using their own drones?
Yes. The Russians use kamikaze drones too. And that's also a factor. So I think overall, in terms of how war is evolving, I think that drones are very important, both the large and then the very small individual sized drones. Open source intelligence has been important for drone targeting. That's another major element.
Can you explain for me what open source intelligence is?
Sure. By that, I mean the ability of individuals, oftentimes they're volunteers, who can just access broad technical capabilities, things like Google Maps and other similar satellite-connected technologies, and see what's happening on the ground and then share information about potential targeting. So open source intelligence has played a bigger role in this war than in past wars. Now, I don't want it to be overstated, though, because open source intelligence was very important in the months before the war began. There were a lot of people who were pointing to what the Russians were doing as they had their long line of, 40 miles of tanks and various capabilities. You know, open source intelligence identified the fact that they were collecting blood, that they were building field hospitals. It was kind of a way to make sure that everybody was aware of what the Russians were doing. And I think open source intelligence is going to be extremely important afterwards.
Now, I have read that the Ukrainian government, Audrey, gave citizens an app that allowed them to provide the government with information about Russian Russian troop movements. How important has that been?
I think it's been extremely important for two reasons. It has helped give the Ukrainian government information, but it's also been a major factor in civilian mobilization, because people are involved in this war. But the other thing about open source intelligence, unfortunately, I think, is that it's going to be far more important after the conflict, or at least once it becomes frozen, because it's going to document the atrocities that are happening.
On that score, are we seeing any documentation taking place so far?
Oh, definitely, yes. It's a little bit difficult to tell sometimes because both sides are engaging in disinformation as well. But I don't think we're going to get a clear picture of everything that has happened until after the war has at least frozen, if not ended.
Okay, so one of the consequences of the technology is that governments can have real-time situational awareness, but also a capacity to document what has actually happened.
Yes, and not just governments, because of course governments have always had classified access to intelligence. It's a key factor in the mobilization of widespread support outside Ukraine and also widespread mobilization within Ukraine. So I think that's a matter of scale and scope and speed more than a change in the actual existence of the thing. But the fact that we've got so many people in the West, especially in Europe and in the United States, who are watching what is happening in Ukraine has been very important to the willingness to provide support for Ukraine.
Okay, I want to pull on that thread because I've been talking about government action, but obviously other actors are influencing and shaping what is transpiring. So let's talk about the big technology media companies and their involvement and how that's played out, Audrey.
Yes, this is an extremely big story because the tech companies have been struggling for years with disinformation, misinformation, malinformation. It's not like calls for violence are new. It's not like their involvement in things like the genocide in Myanmar, the live streaming of the attacks in Christchurch. These things have existed. It's not like the tech companies didn't realize that they were playing a role in violence. However, what is new is that this is the first truly interstate war in which technology companies are playing a key role as geopolitical actors. Their role is bigger and more important than it has been in the past. And what's really interesting is to see how ill-prepared they are.
Well, my sense is many technology companies wish to be neutral. They want to do business. They're in the business of making money. And the more markets you can be in, the better off you are. But that impulse is crashed against reality. I know a number of companies, I think Meta, which has Facebook and Instagram, is finding itself shut out of the Russian market. How is that playing out?
Yes. Well, so if they had their way, the tech companies would be like the Red Cross. You know, they want to be just as neutral and be able to reach out to both sides and support their users on both sides, not to engage in politics. But unfortunately, when you're in a major war, you don't have that kind of choice. If you have power, like companies like Google and Meta, Apple have, that power is going to be controlled or influenced by the states and the actors who are involved in the war. So the tech companies have both blocked access to RT and Sputnik, say, on Google and on YouTube, particularly in Europe. Meta blocked RT and Sputnik on Facebook and Instagram. Meta and Microsoft and Google don't carry any Russian ads anymore. They've had to make a stand against Russian disinformation that way. But at the same time, the Russians have shown a tremendous amount of ability to engage in coercion against the tech companies. This is longstanding because the Google and Apple employees were harassed within Russia long before this war started, but it's really ramped up. So Russia has blocked access to Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and they've criminalized the spreading of information about the war. They're using AI as well to try to search for terms like vojna, war, and invasion. And they're using the ability to search to prosecute their own people. And they've also opened a criminal case against Meta because they're claiming that Meta is an extremist organization. So it's a pretty serious wake-up call, I think, for the tech companies. And I see them as being trapped with very few potential options for how to handle this. And they're really struggling.
We think the flip side of it is that if Facebook, Instagram, and other things are not allowed in Russia, that the Russian people have fewer sources of information, and you essentially create an information desert, or maybe you create an information echo chamber that Putin can dominate.
That is exactly what is happening. But, you know, it's not just companies like Meta and Google and Facebook. It's also, there's been an unprecedented clampdown on traditional types of media outlets in Russia. Even, I would say, even worse than during the Cold War. The Russians are very well experienced in controlling the message in their own country. And this new law that effectively, you know, criminalizes journalism is a huge coercive measure. But in terms of American and Western outlets, the New York Times and Bloomberg have pulled their staffs from Moscow. Washington Post is removing bylines and locations. The BBC has moved toward shortwave broadcasting again. I'm a kid who grew up in the American embassy in Moscow back during the Cold War days. I remember all of this, and we used to have the journalists over to our house to watch films and sort of to help take care of them because we had more resources with access to, you know, the diplomatic pouch and movies and things. So it shocks me that the New York Times has pulled their people from Moscow. That shocks me because even in the worst days of the Cold War, that didn't happen.
Yeah, and certainly is a departure for the New York Times, which historically has kept its reporters in conflict zones throughout conflicts. There's another side, Audrey, of the tech issue, and that is the affirmative support that tech companies or tech impresarios have provided. And I'm thinking here of Elon Musk and his Starlink system of providing internet satellite access to the Ukrainians. How has that played out?
That is one of the most interesting examples of the decentralization that I was talking about before. So you have Starlink, which is 2,000 different satellites that are circulating around and are providing access to the internet to people in Ukraine. In March of 2022, the Starlink app was the most downloaded ever, and mainly in Ukraine. And so Elon Musk is providing that kind of decentralized support, even as the Russians would love to cut off the internet for Ukraine. So that's a huge example of, you know, large numbers of small things that would be very difficult for the Russians to take out all 2,000 Starlink satellites.
Now, my sense is most people listening to this cheer on Elon Musk in doing this. He's doing a good service. But are there geopolitical consequences of having individuals or companies being able to insert themselves in the dynamics of a war situation?
Definitely, because you may be supportive of what Elon Musk has decided to do in this situation, but, you know, he's just also bought a very large share in Twitter, and he believes very strongly in unfettered free speech. He owns a much larger share now than Jack Dorsey. So the question is, will Elon Musk engage in a kind of a open free speech, unlimited free speech approach and pressure Twitter to change any kind of moderation that it has had on the platform? And it's yet to be seen.
And I should note, we're not trying to single out Elon Musk here. I would imagine any big tech company, because of the impact tech has in our lives, the choices it makes have consequences, and we may cheer them in some situations and disapprove of them in other situations.
Exactly.
Audrey, I want to talk a bit more about this broader issue of the information space and information warfare, because there have been a lot of cheers for the Biden administration for its adroit use of information, releasing previously classified information. Can you sort of walk us through how those efforts are shaping the evolution of the conflict?
Well, I think the Biden administration was very smart and took a considerable risk in declassifying information about what the Russians were doing. And the Russians, particularly Vladimir Putin, have a habit of accusing other actors of doing what they intend to do. And so I think it was quite effective on the part of the Biden administration to point out the fact that the Russians were talking about chemical weapons, for example, as a way to try to diffuse the argument that they were going to try to make that the Ukrainians were getting ready to use chemical weapons against them. There were a number of different specific examples where they diffused the ability to use traditional media as well as new media by declassifying traditional classified information. And I think that was something that the Biden administration should be commended for.
I will note that one of the reasons it has proved so effective for the Biden administration is that their predictions proved to be true. We go back only a couple of months, and when this information was first being put out in the U.S. government, joined by the British government as well, signaling that an invasion appeared to be imminent, most of those predictions were dismissed, certainly in Europe, including by the leaders of the intelligence services in countries like France and Germany.
Yes, and also in Ukraine. What we're finding is that President Zelensky, who has become a superstar and has handled the invasion as a very courageous leader, he was actually resisting the intelligence that was brought to him that was actually correct, that the invasion was about to happen. So you had President Zelensky not doing things like testing the air raid sirens and preparing his population for mass evacuation if necessary. You know, some of those kinds of preparations that might have been made had he believed the intelligence much more earnestly than apparently he did.
How important has President Zelensky's use of social media been in the evolution of the conflict? I mean, he has addressed seemingly every national legislature that will give him a platform. He has released videos in a variety of languages targeting a wide range of different groups. How has sort of he as an embodiment of Ukrainian resistance shaped this?
I think he's been utterly brilliant. He has been addressing countries in the languages that those individual countries understand. He presented a kind of a Churchillian style speech to the Brits. He has presented an FDR style speech to the United States. He does his homework. I've been very impressed. He seems to really have the ability to focus his mind, or perhaps his staff does, on exactly what will resonate in different audiences. And it really helps that he's an actor. He reminds me in some ways, there are some parallels, I think, with Ronald Reagan. You know, maybe there are some advantages to having people with very deep acting experiences leading countries.
Now, of course, I'm focusing on Zelensky talking to countries in populations that are sympathetic or supportive of Ukraine, but the information narrative is not just dominated by the Ukrainians. Obviously, in countries like China, getting a very sort of different information flow. How do you see that sort of shaping the nature of the conflict?
Well, I see the internet as being further fractionated by this conflict. So I think it's a driving force that is increasing a tendency that we've seen for a while, which is for China to control its own domestic information zone and for Russia increasingly to clamp down on its own domestic information. And we're seeing a further splitting of the internet. So yes, China is not presenting Zelensky as a hero. It's certainly not the way it's being presented in Russia. In fact, that brings up one other new thing, which has been the use of deepfakes that the Russians have engaged in. They had a very sophisticated deepfake that made it look as if Zelensky was calling for surrender of his people.
Okay, I have to stop you right there because I'm a Luddite when it comes to technology. So what is a deepfake?
Well, a deepfake is an artificial created, usually it's a small video that presents someone as doing something that they never did. So it takes a lot of frames and pictures of individuals and then it pieces them together. So, and you can often tell a deepfake because it'll be a little bit choppy, but it'll use little bits of language and bits of recordings that are accessible all over the internet, especially for high-profile people, and build something that is completely inaccurate that the person never said. And Zelensky, the fact that he was all over the internet and was so high-profile, that made it very easy for the Russians to create a deep fake of him. And fortunately, I think people are becoming a little more sophisticated in recognizing them, but there was a lot of risk involved in that kind of a operation, and the Russians were very clever to do it.
Are we moving, Audrey, to a point where deep fakes will be so good that you won't be able to tell them from the real thing?
I think that's already happened, especially for people that aren't familiar with them. You know, the other thing that often happens is that people will have artificial photographs of humans that don't exist with profiles on LinkedIn or on social media platforms, and they're piecing together different pieces of other humans. And you have to study them very closely in order to be able to tell a real photograph from a phony photograph. You have to look at things like, you know, is there a discontinuation in that little piece of hair? Or, you know, does the color of the outfit seem to change? That you have to really pay attention. And most people just don't have time for that. So they're drawn in.
Yeah, I would say people seem to be inclined to jump to a conclusion. They see a video and move on from that, or they don't even necessarily see the video. They rely on other people telling them what the video says and they draw inferences on that basis. So what you're suggesting is people are going to have to learn to invest more time in trying to distinguish between what's real and what's fake.
Yes. And isn't it infuriating? Because none of us have time. But I also think that we're going to begin to use AI-driven means to try to separate real from fake. That already is a tool that people are testing, and it'll be the longer-term solution, I think, for most platforms.
Now, one of the things I found surprising about the evolution of the war in Ukraine, Audrey, has been the dog that didn't bark or hasn't appeared to have barked. Before the invasion, we heard a lot of speculation that the Russian movement would be coupled with significant cyber attacks, either against Ukraine or against the West more broadly. We haven't, however, to the best of my knowledge, seen a large-scale cyber attack. Why is that?
Well, there have been small-scale cyber attacks, but also I think your question is a really good question that nobody has a great answer to. I think the Russians can do much more than they've done. It could be that they're very worried about blowback, because anytime you engage in a cyber operation, you can take down your own parts of your own systems as well. But I think they may also be saving up for something in the future. And in particular, particular, it's really time to back up all your systems in the United States and in Europe, because I think Russian cyber attacks are likely in our future.
What about the flip side of it? One of the concerns I've heard over the years is the fear that if a war broke out, that partisans on both sides would use cyber. So it's not just the Russians going after U.S. systems or Ukrainian systems, but that you would have so-called patriotic hackers, maybe Ukrainians, maybe Americans, Germans, Brits, going after the Russian internet, Russian cyber.
Yeah, well, some of that has happened. Anonymous has been involved in attacks on Russia. Some of that has already happened. I think the bigger story here is that I've always felt that cyber received a little more hype than it should when it came to its role within old-fashioned shooting wars. It is important in terms of maintaining connection on each side, but I think it can be easily overstated because we still have old-fashioned bombs and artillery that are making the big difference on the battlefield. And although I still believe that we have cyber attacks in our future, the influence on how the war unfolds is probably going to be less than we've always predicted.
So as you look at all of these developments, Audrey, and try to tease together broader lessons, where do you come out? And I will admit, again, we're at the beginning, I think, not the end of this conflict, that there's still a lot more to be learned. But what are some of your preliminary lessons learned from this? And I will ask it particularly in the light of a lot of speculation you've already heard about what this means for Taiwan and potential Chinese interest in forcibly reunifying Taiwan with China.
I understand why the Taiwanese are worried about that. But I actually think that a lot of what's coming out of this war should give Taiwan considerable reason for hope, because the Ukrainians, having been a pretty sophisticated economy when it comes to technology, aerospace, cyber, they've been quite effective at mobilizing their population and resisting the Russian invasion. And it's taken a high cost from the Russians. That's not to say that I'm being a Panglossian person here, because I think that bombing and artillery, if the Russians are simply going to shift over, which I really fear is what's happening now, from the kinds of operations that they've engaged in the last month and a half, and what they're more traditionally inclined to do, which is to simply bomb indiscriminately and take over through overall brute force, I think that is perhaps in the future for Ukraine. But nonetheless, we've seen remarkable resistance of this invasion, and the Chinese have got to be paying attention to that too. They would pay a very high price if they were to try to invade Taiwan, and the Taiwanese can learn a lot from what the Ukrainians can do. I do think that one of the key things that I would draw from this conflict relates to the tech companies and the fact that they really are very bad at dealing with wars. And I see them as having four major options, and they've kind of tried all of them. And I'm not really sure how it's going to come out after the war in Ukraine. I mean, they started out by being completely dedicated to unrestrained free speech, and that made them complicit in violence. So, you know, there was some, you know, moderation, using contractors to moderate material on their platforms and labels and so on. But that was really around the edges. So the second thing is to act in the interests of their users. That's one of the arguments that people make about how the tech companies can navigate wartime. But the problem is that there are users on both sides. And so if you're falling, you know, on the side of one side, you're, as we've discussed before, neglecting Russian needs for information. So the third thing is to adapt to local national laws. And they've certainly been doing that, but that leads to unsavory compromises and makes them look very hypocritical. I mean, it leads to, you know, what happened in with Google and Facebook and Twitter being blocked in China. It leads to the kind of struggle that's going on right now in India with the government and the tech companies fighting over exactly, you know, what the moderation should look like. And then the last one is to choose sides according to your principles. And so you've seen some of that with Meta, censoring some speech. That has its downsides too, because it's contributing to this very fractionation of the internet that was already underway. And it leads to increased competitors within those countries, you know, things like WeChat in China and Ku in India. And in Russia, it's VKontakte.
So it sounds like the utopian promise of the tech companies that we embraced and enjoyed in the 90s has taken a dystopian turn.
Yes. And I think that the tech companies are a long way to figuring out how exactly to behave. I do think that they are important geopolitical actors. I think that their role is underappreciated when it comes to looking at traditional power politics. But that's not to say that they're like major nation states that have any kind of understanding of what to do in terms of diplomacy and defense policy and all that bureaucracy involved. They're geopolitical actors, but they're extremely inexperienced. And to some degrees, I think that many of them are naive.
Well, and I would imagine that existing governments are now trying to figure out how to work with or use tech companies to accomplish their goals and objectives. objectives.
Yes. So the amount of coercion that's going on with respect to tech companies is growing sharply, and this only increases the pincer movement against them.
Audrey, I actually want to shift gears as we come to the close of our conversation and take advantage of the fact that you once wrote a book called Great Power Politics and the Struggle Over Austria, 1945 to 1955. And the reason I point to this is because there's been a lot of talk in the last couple of days, few weeks, about the possibility of Ukraine becoming neutral. And obviously, that was an issue that was significant with Austria at the dawn of the Cold War. Can you just sort of help us think about neutrality as a concept and whether it applies at all to the Ukraine situation, or perhaps there are lessons from what you saw in Austria that would warn you or warn us going forward?
Well, the most important lesson is that neutrality only works if the country involved is actively seeking it. So there is no way that any kind of neutrality could work if it were imposed by Russia or by any of the European powers. Imposed neutrality goes back to the 19th century and earlier. We're over that. So it's never been successful in the 20th century if it is imposed without the willingness of the country itself.
So Ukraine has to, number one, embrace the idea.
Yes. And that has the potential for costs, serious costs for them. It could mean giving up territory, particularly in the Donbass. I think they're already somewhat resigned with respect to Crimea. The question of what territory exactly would be neutral, that's crucial.
You need borders.
You need borders. And that's one of the ways that Ukraine is very different from a country like Austria. The borders of Austria, there was some fighting over the southern border, and that had to be resolved or at least settled before Austria could become neutral. But, you know, Austria's neutrality was sought by the Austrians. They flew to Moscow and presented a proposal. This was in the aftermath of Stalin's death. It was because Stalin, I think, had passed that Khrushchev decided that it was in his interest to have a neutral country. He was trying to provide an opportunity or a kind of a parallel for Germany. He didn't want Germany to rearm. And so Austria was supposed to be the implicit example of what the Germans should do. It didn't work out that way, but the Austrians were militarized. They were allowed to maintain defensive military capabilities. I think that's an element that's very important for Ukraine. I actually think Ukraine would have to be armed to the teeth in order to be successful as a neutral country.
But I can't imagine Russia wants Ukraine to be armed to the teeth. One of the justifications for the invasion in the first place was the need to demilitarize Ukraine.
That's right. So that's one of the key reasons why I think that it's going to be very difficult to achieve a neutrality agreement. I think it would be a good solution for Ukraine, assuming that this talk of denazification, which basically means regime change, and demilitarization that Putin loves to harp on, if both of those things continue to be in place, I think it's very unlikely that neutrality is going to be a successful solution for Ukraine. And in fact, I think the Russians may be using it strictly as a diversion of our attention. That doesn't mean that I believe that neutrality would be a bad outcome, but it would have to be neutrality that allowed robust defenses on the part of the Ukrainians. The other piece of neutrality that's very risky from the point of view of the West, I would say, is that as these negotiations have been haltingly going on, there's been talk of a Western guarantee.
Security guarantee.
Exactly. That would be quite potentially dangerous because the Ukrainians, Zelensky is discussing the possibility of a guarantee by France, Britain, and the United States, the three Western nuclear powers. If that were to be put in place somehow, that would be equivalent to an Article 5 agreement. That would be, you know, obviously the Ukrainians couldn't join NATO. That would have to be a part of their neutrality agreement because it's fundamental that a neutral country not join a military alliance, but it would be a backdoor to achieving an Article 5 guarantee.
Sort of joining NATO without actually formally joining NATO.
Yes, exactly. And I think that the people on both ends of the spectrum, talking about the great potential for neutrality and talking about neutrality as appeasement, they're both wrong. We have to get to the middle here. The devil is truly in the details. So if it's security guarantees by the Western powers, that could be very potentially destabilizing. But the other possibility, of course, would be that if there were security guarantees that include, the P5, if you had China as one of the guarantors, they would be aligned with Russia. And how exactly would they define the terms? What would be described as a violation of neutrality? That would all have to be discussed and laid out. And this is a long-term process. Neutrality is a complicated thing. So I think it is a potential way out, but it has a lot of potential pitfalls and both, you know, sort of overzealous enthusiasm and, you know, criticism of the option, they're both wrong.
So what I'm hearing you say, Audrey, is the devil is in the details. details. When it comes to neutrality, there are an awful lot of details.
Yes, and there are bits and pieces of other historical examples that might apply to Ukraine. Certainly, the neutralization of Switzerland has been very successful. The behavior on the part of the Finns, adhering to a political neutrality, the Swedes, all of these countries can teach the Ukrainians a lot. But Ukraine is probably going to be building a brand new model if it's going to be a neutral country.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Audrey Kurth Cronin, Distinguished Professor in the School of International Service and Founding Director of the Center for Security, Innovation, and New Technology at American University. Audrey, thank you for joining me.
It's been a pleasure, Jim. Thank you for having me.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. You can find the books and articles mentioned in this episode, as well as a transcript of our conversation, on the podcast page for the President's Inbox on CFR.org. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.